You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of January 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, a week after sanctions were dropped, Iran's president touches down in Italy in search of friends in the business world. How lucrative could Hassan Rouhani's trip prove to be? Plus, 5 years on from the uprising in Egypt that saw its leader toppled, Cairo is again on high alert as authorities raid thousands of homes in a bid to muffle protests. We'll also look at the spiralling situation in Venezuela as inflation is set to nudge 750%. And later on, Australia's National Day of Celebration has many suffering an identity crisis. Could it be time to revive plans for a republic? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are former British diplomat John Everard and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck's University of London. Welcome to you both. We'll begin today with Hassan Rouhani. Now, being the president of Iran isn't exactly the most diplomatically straightforward position in the world, but after last week's nuclear deal saw the lifting of sanctions against the Islamic Republic, the country is now on something of a charm offensive in a bid to entice international business. It's understood the president will drum up about $18 billion worth of deals with Italian firms as he visits this week before heading to France to sign an agreement with Airbus. John Everard, I guess this is the inevitable opening up that happens after sanctions are lifted.
Well, that's right. And I hope it all works out. I hope the guys do business. I can't help feeling just a little bit pessimistic, to be honest. I mean, Iran has done this as it's allowed to sell its oil, which is good, but at a time when the oil price has hit historic lows, at a time when both France and Italy are, to put it simply, broke. If you want to look for investment into Iran, Paris and Rome are the last places you go. He's gone there for good historic reasons. I mean, they're traditionally Iran's friends in Europe. But apart from the famous the French joint venture car plant in Iran, I would be pleasantly surprised if much more comes from this. There's already been announced. The Airbus, okay, big deal, but not more than that. Remember Khatami. 1999, the last phase of opening, went and did exactly the same thing. And the same excitement, the same expectation of a great release of money, lots of wealth all around, and then nothing. And I am getting this slow, sick feeling of déjà vu.
And yet, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, the oil price might be low, but Iran has enormous reserves, which it's been holding in these floating tankers going around the world, not being able to land in any port at all. They've got enough to be able to buy a few things, haven't they?
They do, but John is absolutely on the money. The problem here is they're running out of places to go and find money because nobody has it. And yes, you can have oil reserves, but nowadays they do not necessarily translate in the kind of investment that you would require, particularly if, as it happens in Iran, you need to revamp infrastructure in a big way. Now, I'm more optimistic and actually much more interested in the meeting between Rouhani and Pope Francis. I'm much more interested in the kinds of exchanges that we might see in terms of, you know, an Ali Shariati kind of, you know, turn in theology and Francis.
You don't foresee big investment from the Vatican, then?
Unfortunately not. Other than a spiritual?
We'll come on to some of the diplomatic moves that we can expect this week. But to stick just for a moment on the economy, John, you mentioned, obviously, there is a car plant in Iran, that there are these sort of automotive deals that Iran could do with France. And then there is the other aspect as well, which is that there is a lot of things from cars all the way through to planes that are a little bit old and shaky in Iran at the moment, and they could do with some new ones.
Yes, absolutely. No, the needs are there. Infrastructure, as Oscar rightly says, spare parts for your aircraft, some new cars wouldn't go amiss. Fine, all that I can see. The question is this money. Lots and lots of oil, as you just said, but oil at about $21 a barrel right now for Iranian oil, might be around $25 in a few days' time, they're saying. It's really not going to go as far as it once would have done.
So, Oscar, if you were an economic advisor to Hassan Rouhani, where would you have suggested that he make this sort of trip, this sort of business trip, to drum up some support, to try and find people that might want whatever money he has?
Well, go to the US. that seems. But having said that, I mean, part of the problem is that this is a global downward spiral. It's not just, it's everywhere. So I would have said China before, but certainly that story is over. So
is that then part of the problem, John, that actually wherever you stuck a pin in the map, you would struggle to find somewhere where they're going to have enough money to invest in Iran, enough money and enough capabilities?
Hmm. Yes and yes. I mean, the a bit off this conversation, but of course all the economic experts are agonizing and gnashing their teeth over the possibility of another great world crash brought on by a Chinese depression, slowdown in various other countries, and a contraction in developing markets, of which, of course, Iran is one. This is not a great time to go around looking for investment.
Oscar, you mentioned obviously this is not just a business trip. You know, he's doing a little bit more than staying in a hotel and raiding the minibar at the end of the night. He's having diplomatic meetings while he's there. He'll be meeting with Francois Hollande, with Matteo Renzi, and as you said, with Pope Francis. What do you think this suggests the next stage is for diplomatic relations between Iran and these two European nations?
Well, in all the cases you mentioned, the next step is to set up, further relations and cultural exchanges. I would think that that's going to be the next step. Also, if as it is the case, the economic side of things is not going to look very good. So, what you would do is to go for education and cultural exchanges between these countries. There are enough ties between Iran and Paris, or is it Tehran and Paris? And also in the case of Francis, of Pope Francis, this is a triumph for his peace initiative. He was, let us remember that he was one of the first ones to support a peaceful solution to, the crisis in Iran.
The other big piece on the diplomatic agenda, of course, is Syria. I mean, we know that Rouhani will want to try to persuade both France and Italy to row back from their demand that Assad stands down. But all this comes just, what, a week, 10 days after it emerges that not many weeks ago, Putin tried to persuade Assad to stand down. Now, if Russia is in that game, then is Iran? And are there going to be conversations behind locked doors that might just push Syria to something closer to a political solution?
I think you're absolutely right. In fact, we had talked about that possibility in this program, a few months ago, that the next step in the Syria game would be backstep from the strong support for Assad. I think we will see developments in that area.
How important are France and Italy in this conversation, though? Because, let's face it, when it comes to Syria, the big players are Russia and the US. Do you think there are conversations that Rouhani can have with Hollande and Matteo Renzi that will, that maybe are sort of in some ways proxies for John Kerry, that can sort of at least sort of help get a sense for the West generally about what Iran is thinking?
Absolutely. I have no doubt at all that within minutes of Rouhani getting on his plane back, the United States ambassador in Paris will charge through the door of the Quai d'Orsay and say, please, please, please tell us all about it. And the French will debrief thoroughly. Yes, in this kind of situation, France, Italy, any major Western power can be used as a proxy and will be.
And in terms of what this visit means, I mean, is it just a symbolic visit that this is Rouhani sort of signalling that, yes, Iran is coming in from the cold, as it were, we're back, we're doing business, we're buying some of your planes, we're taking part in high-level diplomatic negotiations? Is it more the symbolism than the actuality of what might be discussed?
Well, it's not just symbolism. The case of Syria and developments in that area are substantial. And John is absolutely right. Just as France and Italy may act as proxies for the US, Iran is in communication with Russia. So we're seeing an interesting rapprochement in between the various would-be partners in this endeavor.
This is a rare good news story, isn't it, John?
Yes, it is. I mean, getting Rouhani, who is, as Iranian leaders go, relatively sane, open, and a very interesting person to talk to, out talking face-to-face with Western leaders against a relatively benign backdrop is good news. Let's just hope we can build on this and move the process forward.
Okay, let's turn our attention to Cairo now, where authorities are once again on high alert, 5 years after the uosrising that saw the nation's leader Hosni Mubarak toppled. The symbolic centre of that uprising, Tahrir Square, is swarming with police while thousands of homes have been raided in a bid to stamp out protests. Human rights organisations across the world say the situation in Egypt has never been worse since President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi came to power in 2013. More than 1,000 people have been killed, while about 40,000 are believed to have been jailed. Oscar, when you look back on the events of 5 years ago, and there's been a lot of talk, obviously, in the last few days about, you know, whether people were overly optimistic. But in many ways, it seems like the situation is far worse now in Egypt than it was then, when at least you had a sort of the dying days of a dictatorship. Now you have a dictator very firmly back in control.
Oh, I have no doubts about it. I was there 3 months ago and I could see it for myself. Some people would will tell you that, well, the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood is out of business is a good thing, and that, you know, things are on the up and so on. But then when you keep talking to them, you begin to sense, you know, a certain nostalgia for a missed opportunity. What we have seen here is the cycle of revolution and counter-revolution. And although, of course, people would, you know, openly support al-Sisi, most people, particularly if they, like most people, depend on the government, you know, more privately, they will say, well, we are definitely in a much worse situation. And when you walk around Cairo, you can see it for yourself. Mm. All this business with, you know, the Tutankhamun's mask being botched, well, you see the general state of decay in the city and around the city. I was lucky not to go too far from the city, because just 2 days after I left, a troupe of Mexican tourists was killed by the military. I would very easily would have taken by one of them. So the situation on the ground in Egypt is just deplorable.
And John, when you look back to those scenes 5 years ago, even at the time, it was clear that it wasn't the toppling of a regime. It was the removal of the man at the top. Everything else pretty much stayed in place, even when there were then elections. The military didn't lose too much control then.
No, that's right. There was not a root and branch change of the system. Perhaps that was too much to hope for that. And I've been very interested to listen to the comments by people who've now come out saying 5 years on, can we please admit the revolution was a catastrophic failure? Not a position I necessarily agree with. And some of them are saying this because they are rich, powerful. I want to stay that way. But a lot of people are saying that the revolution was a mistake because Mubarak was crumbling. And it would have been better to let the system crumble slowly and organically, as a kind of gradual transition into something softer and more liberal, than to try to topple everything at once. I mean, we'll never know, but it strikes me as a point of view that's not completely stupid.
Although on that issue, you can't know at the time that that's necessarily going to be a better way to go.
No, the retrospectoscope is a wonderful instrument in these occasions. We will never know what would have happened, and people on the ground at the time could not possibly have foreseen what was going to come. So, you know, we say this with all the benefit of hindsight. Nevertheless, I mean, I think the argument of gradual as opposed to sudden change is an interesting one.
Well, the problem, of course, is that, it's difficult to reason by counterfactuals. Couldn't know, and those who were involved in the revolution at the time could not know that it would go this way. They were mindful of the risks, and the great risk of any revolution is a counter-revolution. And in this particular case, you can see also that other powers, you know, external powers, you know, the US and so on, were not interested in allowing this sort of change. Actually, I'm very doubtful that we would have seen a sort of gradual transformation. If we hadn't seen it, given the upheaval and the fact that the majority of the people were in the streets, I don't think we would have seen it absent that moment of rupture. Having said that, I understand very well those who are wary and say that the revolution was a setback. Of course, if you see the situation now, you could think that. But there are also many among the younger population in particular who say that the 25th January was, they're proud of having participated in it, and that the problem was what came later.
It is a date that will go down in history, and I quite understand their pride. I mean, to have the courage to stand up against the dictatorship is quite something, and I applaud this. Would it have changed? I've just said we don't know the future. We do know a bit about the past, and people who have opposed revolution have said quite articulately that if you look at Mubarak at the point that he fell, and Mubarak 10 years previously, you can see a slow progress towards a much less repressive regime. It became much easier to say things in public, the police were getting much less fierce, and there was movement towards more liberalisation. Whether it would have gone forward, we're never going to find out.
When we look at history, there was obviously one period of recent history that many people referred back to during what we really can't now call the Arab Spring, but hey, let's still call it that, which was the revolutions in Eastern Europe in 1989 and in the 2 years after that as well. And yet those were very different, John, from revolutions previously. When you look at, for example, the French Revolution, you had the storming of Bastille in 1789, you then had Louis losing his head 2 or 3 years later, then you had the Jacobin Terror, then eventually Napoleon takes control 12 years later, and that's no democracy. These things take enormous amount of time, don't they?
Yes, they do. The French Revolution is an interesting parallel there too. The military never quite lost power, and effectively what Napoleon did was to install himself at the head of a military machine that had never quite been demolished by the revolutionaries. The big difference with Eastern Europe was that a lot of these countries did have the kind of root and branch change that just never happened in Egypt. I mean, when Jaruzelski fell in Poland, the military's prestige fell with him, and the military withdrew from politics for long enough for Malesa and his people effectively to take over. Something the same happened in Czechoslovakia as then was, and I won't go through item to item, but I mean, there were sort of very different dynamics going on. And again, it's easy, isn't it, with the benefit of hindsight, to say how different things were then. But I have to say that I think that taking Eastern Europe as a model for the revolution to the Arab Spring was perhaps misguided.
And I guess also, Oscar, when people look at revolutions and the impact that they've had and what and how their lives have changed, the big thing for many Egyptians, and you can look at other nations as well in the region, is that individuals' lives haven't got any better because of the revolution, have they?
They haven't. I wouldn't say that it was because of the revolution. It's the whole cycle, revolution and counter-revolution.
Sure, but there is nothing you can look at and go, well, look, we got rid of this regime and now we have jobs.
You're absolutely right on that respect. And that's one difference with the Eastern revolutions. I agree with both of you that that comparison is misguided for various reasons. I mean, the histories of these parts of two parts of the world are completely different. Yes, one was part of what you could call a USSR empire. But on the other side, you have the longer history of colonialism. And those demands and dreams are still there. Those haven't gone.
I want to just move on to one final point on this, and that is what the rest of the world can do, what impact the rest of the world can have on Egypt right now in terms of where it goes next. And I don't want to just look at the role of the West, though we'll look at that. But I mean, Oscar, when you look at the role that Latin American nations could play in trying to promote democracy, in trying to push for more freedoms in Egypt, are you disappointed that they haven't been pushing perhaps as much as they could have?
I am. In fact, I recall being in Qatar near the time of the so-called Arab Spring and being reminded of the closer links between Egyptian surrealists and Latin American surrealists and how that panned out in terms of an internationalist movement that had consequences in terms of international law and so on. None of that is here now. And there is a sense of isolation of different parts of the world, which also makes makes things much more difficult.
And also, you can, you know, there are examples. You can have, you know, Brazilians saying, look, we've got rid of our military dictatorship. This is how we did it. This is how we moved on. Chile the same. Argentina the same. Now, there are obviously issues with all three of those democracies in their own ways, but they have something far more that you can fall back on than perhaps the Western nations.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the one big difference here is that in Egypt, they couldn't get rid of the military. They're still there. That's the thing.
And the reason, the big difference was that in most of the Latin American examples, it was because the military themselves decided that holding on to power was just too difficult and too dangerous. The military in Egypt never quite reached that position. They wanted to stay in there, and they did.
One other thing then, just on this issue before we move on, and that is that because Egypt isn't one country on its own in a, you know, in a peaceful region, it is still one of the largest and most important countries in the Arab world, John. It's meant that for the West, they have been far more interested in having an Egypt that they can rely on for support elsewhere in the region rather than pushing for democracy.
No, I don't think that's right. I think that the West has been conflicted over this. I mean, yes, obviously, they want an Egypt that's a useful partner for other regional objectives.
Yeah, and America still gives $1.5 billion in military aid every year. The UK still has very close ties with the Egyptian military. You don't hear any British ministers talking about human rights abuses by Sisi. In fact, we just rolled out the red carpet for him last year.
No, you're right, we don't. At the same time,
nobody uses the term dictator.
Sorry?
No.
Nobody uttered the term dictator.
No, nobody uttered the term dictator. Now, at the same time, you know, I think there is real concern at where the Egypt is going, and I hope that it will actually come right, and probably quite a lot of nudging behind the scenes. Whether you would actually achieve anything by cutting that military aid on being more forthright with Sisi, I don't know. Someone clearly decided not.
Okay, we'll leave it there. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. I'll be back with John Everard and Oscar Guardiola Rivera after this.
Monocle has bureaus around the world in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Istanbul, our bureau chief is Christopher Lord.
From our bureau in Karaköy, we're extremely close to the heart of the city. We've got a view towards the Golden Horn. So from here, we're able to not only look across Turkey towards Anatolia, but also further towards Central Asia and that extremely important shipping lane at the Bosphorus is to Central Asia.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in studio, John Everard and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. The low price of oil, as we've been hearing, is a thorn in the side of many nations in the market. But perhaps no one is feeling the jab quite as badly at the moment as Venezuela. The International Monetary Fund predicts that inflation in the country will hit 750% this year, make it by far the highest in the world. And that's not the only thing. The IMF also says its economy will shrink by 8% in addition to the 10% contraction seen last year. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, how's that for the Bolivarian Revolution?
Well, this, in fact, is affecting not only the Bolivarian Revolution, and it does not reflect that specific process on its own. Of course, one should not, fall short of criticizing what needs to be criticized about the Bolivarian Revolution. But in fact, the man who has been vindicated in all of this is a Venezuelan anthropologist by the name of Fernando Coronil, who both predicted the rise to power of Hugo Chavez before anyone had heard about the colonel, and also predicted that if the revolution, continued to gamble its fate on the money of coming from oil sales, it would fail at some point. It would reach its limit, and that's exactly what we have seen. Now, this is a problem that is affecting all Latin American countries. The whole region is contracting. Colombia, the neighborhood
not
country,
at 750%,
not at the same level, of course, but actually inflation and the exchange rate in Colombia is shooting up. There are concerns, and again, as I said, there is no need to left the Bolivarians off the hook. They have made clear mistakes in terms of their economic policies. But the problem lies in the oil power, and that's outside of the hands.
Oscar,
clear mistakes. Oscar, this is economic mismanagement of epic proportions. But there's no, you cannot really compare Venezuela with Colombia. Come on.
Actually, you can. Actually,
no,
you
let's
can.
Hear from John. No, let's hear from on. John. No,
look, Oscar, over the last 17 years, the oil bonanza for Venezuela has been $1.3 trillion. I mean, this is the kind of money that transforms countries, infrastructure, new roads, hospitals in every village, complete healthcare systems, education, everywhere, all gone, all squandered, and back to a level of living that you people under Carlos Andrés Pérez used to complain of poverty. But the poverty we see now in Venezuela is way beyond anything that came before Chávez.
I'm afraid that is not true. You know, when you say that people used to complain during Pérez, let us remind ourselves that it was the Caracazo under Carlos Andrés Pérez which started the process that ended with Chávez. So people were not just complaining. They were taking to the streets to revolt against that particular regime, who had received, you know, huge quantities of oil money for a very long time and did squander them. In the case of the Bolivarians, there, you know, the United Nations has been clear about the gains. I am not going to, you know, to say here that everything they did was correct, but I think it's an overstatement to say that all they did was just a terrible economic mismanagement. There's the same narrative that we heard about Chile in the 1970s.
The Castroleos were against corruption. They were against mismanagement of power. I think had the people who came onto those streets to bang their saucepans against Carlos Andrés Pérez realized what was going to happen, they would have quietly put their saucepans away and gone back to
court. Well, clearly not. 45% of them voted for the Bolivarians in the previous elections. So yes. Not everybody is equally...
We've done the past. Let's look at the future then. Okay. So Oscar, what happens next? Because we're in a situation now where even the firmest supporters of the Bolivarian Revolution would say that actually this fellow Nicolas Maduro is perhaps not quite up to the job. There's been, you know, it's fair to say that when it comes to democracy, it hasn't been the smoothest ride for Venezuela at the moment. How does Venezuela get out of this mess?
Well, there has to be a dialogue with the opposition, with that part of the opposition that still believes in democracy. Not everyone in the Venezuelan opposition believes in democracy. But there is a sector led by Enrique Capriles who seems to do so. There needs to be a dialogue between them and, you know, those who are still left in the Bolivarians with enough reasonableness within them to realize that what is needed is a national unity moment.
Yes, fine. The problem is that it's quite obvious that this regime has no intention whatsoever of having dialogue
with
the opposition.
Again, that is not true. Dialogue is taking place. They have taken place in the past. Again, you have to distinguish between that sector of the opposition in Venezuela who is reactive against any sort of dialogue as some sectors within the Maduro regime. But there are those who are trying to work it, to make it work for the rest of the people.
Just watch what Maduro's done over the past couple of weeks. We had this fiasco in December where Maduro finally lost control of his Congress. 5th of January, the new opposition-dominated Congress comes in. In the 10 days before that, he strips Congress of all its power, making sure that nobody but nobody, and certainly not the Congress, is going to stop him, Maduro, running the economy yet further into the ground. He appoints the economic czar, Luis Salas, the man who believes that inflation is a bourgeois invention. And you think this man is going to engage in dialogue with the opposition?
They are already in dialogue with the opposition. They must get in dialogue with the opposition. They know it. Of course, they also have to use the kind of rhetoric that is expected of them. But if you look at the economic team around Salas, you begin to see that on the one side, they're trying to get back to, you know, in connection with the social movements, but at the same time, building bridges with the opposition.
We were going to talk about whether Australia should become a republic, but because we've got quite heated about Venezuela, we've only got about 40 seconds left. So let's very briefly talk about whether Australia should become a republic. It is Australia Day just about now in Australia. Australia, John, now has a Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, who does believe in republicanism. Lots of the premiers in Australia have said they back it as well. Is it going to happen?
Possibly, but remember the 1999, when we had this referendum that actually went against it, the opinion poll said that people would vote for Republic. When it came to the crunch, in the voting booths, they went against it. I think the same would happen again.
It won't happen.
Oscar?
It won't happen.
It won't happen. There we are. We didn't need more than 40 seconds. That was Midori House. Thank you very much to John Everard and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Today's programme was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Eugenie Deray. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Carlotta Ribello is here next. Then at 1900, it's Culture with Rob Bound. At 2200, it's The Monocle Daily. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. That's 1300 if you're listening in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.